The Eight Immortals Travel East, Chapter 46.
Have you ever tried to show off for your friends, like really show off, only to have it backfire so spectacularly that you accidentally start a war?
It is the worst feeling.
Right. Because today, we are looking at a pantheon of ancient deities who did exactly that.
We've got a really whirled one today.
We absolutely do. We are jumping into a brilliantly chaotic excerpt from Chapter 46 of the classic text Journey to the East. Specifically, we're looking at the famous story of the Eight Immortals crossing the sea.
And our mission today isn't just to recount some dusty myth. We are going to unpack the surprisingly human psychology at play here.
Yeah, and we'll explore the physical realities of ancient publishing that created some incredibly quirky continuity errors. Plus, we're tracing this rapidly escalating cycle of hubris hidden within the magical tale. So, okay, let's unpack this.
To really understand the stakes of this story, we have to look at the physical setting the text provides first. The Eight Immortals have arrived at the shore of the East Sea. And the author makes a deliberate point to describe this body of water not as some calm, glassy lake, but as a terrifying natural barrier.
Right, it's not a vacation spot.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The text highlights the turbulent tides, the surging waters, and these huge crashing waves. It is a really imposing, dangerous environment.
And considering we are talking about enlightened, magical beings who literally possess the power to ride on clouds, I mean, the most logical, efficient thing to do would be to just fly over it.
You would think so, yeah.
They could take the VIP sky route and completely avoid the turbulent water altogether.
Right, but that would be the drama-free method. And where is the fun in that? Lu Dongbin, who is one of the most prominent immortals in the group, looks out at this terrifying ocean and proposes something entirely different.
He essentially issues a dare, right?
He does. He tells the group that if they simply ride the clouds across, they aren't displaying their individual magical skill.
Of course.
So he suggests that instead of flying, they should each throw an object onto the surface of the churning water and use their unique powers to ride those objects across the sea.
I mean, it is the ultimate performative flex. I look at this scene, and the first thing that comes to mind is the modern billionaire space race.
Oh, that is a perfect comparison.
It has absolutely nothing to do with getting to a destination efficiently or, you know, advancing the collective good. It is a purely ego-driven stunt to prove exactly how stylishly you can travel compared to your peers.
Yeah.
It's vanity masquerading as a fun group challenge.
The comparison to an elite ego-driven stunt is incredibly accurate. Especially when you look at the items they choose to use, the rest of the immortals just, they accept this dare without a second thought.
Because they can't back down.
Exactly. And the text provides this meticulously detailed catalog of exactly what these divine beings throw into the violent waves. Like, Iron Crutchlaw uses his iron crutch standing on top of it to ride the wind.
Just surfing on a crutch.
Yeah. And Zhongli throws down a fly whisk.
I'll add Zhongli Lao to that list because he uses a paper donkey.
Yes.
It is an incredibly surreal visual, right?
Yeah.
A delicate paper construct being tossed onto a stormy ocean.
It makes no physical sense, but the underlying magic completely overrides the physical reality of the objects. Lu Dongbin uses a musical flute as his vessel.
Mm.
Han Shanzi throws in a flower basket.
And Yanggu uses a bamboo basket, right?
She does, yeah.
There is a really interesting philosophical undercurrent to those choices, I think.
Right.
Because these aren't grand galleons or armored ships. They're everyday, mundane items.
Huh.
You know, a crutch, a basket, a flute.
Right.
It feels like a statement that in the hands of an enlightened being, the ordinary becomes divine.
That is actually a core tenet of Taoist folklore, this elevation of the mundane. But the final two items on the list introduce a really fascinating complication into the text itself.
Here we go.
Lan Kaihe throws down a jade tablet. And Cao Guojiu uses a set of clappers. Those are a traditional musical percussion instrument. Well, the text specifies that these magical items, and particularly that jade tablet, are emitting a blindingly bright white light.
Ah, right. That light is the match that lights the powder keg.
Exactly.
Because while the immortals are up on the surface enjoying their little billionaire space race, just showing off their glowing toys for one another, that light is piercing straight down into the pitch black depths of the ocean.
It is.
It illuminates the crystal palaces of the underwater kingdom, outshining the natural world down there.
And the sudden, inexplicable illumination completely disrupts the ecosystem of the Dragon King's realm. The entire ocean becomes transparent.
Which must have been terrifying for them.
Oh, absolutely. The Dragon King has no idea what is causing this phenomenon, so he dispatches Crown Prince Mo Ji to investigate the disturbance.
And the prince swims up toward the surface, takes one look at Lan Kai floating on this incredibly flashy, glowing jade tablet, and decides on the spot that he needs to own it.
He just has to have it.
Yeah. And the text makes a point to outline the prince's internal monologue here, which is fascinating. He reminds himself that down in his dragon palace, he possesses absolutely everything.
Right.
The phrase used translates to having 10,000 treasures fully equipped. He's completely surrounded by wealth.
He lacks nothing in terms of material or magical resources, yet he looks at this tablet and admits he has never seen an object so marvelous.
It's pure greed.
It really is. His logic is terrifying in its simplicity. He basically says, because I want it and because they won't simply give it to me, I must take it by force.
So what does this all mean? To put that psychology into a modern context, imagine an obscenely wealthy person who lives in a gated, sprawling mega mansion filled to the brim with priceless Renaissance art. One day, they look out their window, see that their neighbor has a really unique, glowing plastic flamingo on their lawn, and they decide they're willing to commit a violent felony just to steal that specific lawn ornament.
That is exactly what happened.
It has nothing to do with need.
Yeah.
It is pure, unadulterated covetousness.
Yeah, and this sequence can easily be read as a satirization of the ruling class during the Ming Dynasty.
Oh, interesting.
You have these elites who possess everything, but will gleefully destroy lives for a novelty simply because it represents something outside their dominion.
Right.
So the prince orders his aquatic soldiers to attack. They ambush the surface, snatch the jade tablet, and in the ensuing chaos, they drag Lan Kai He down into the depths of the sea.
So they don't just steal the flamingo, they kidnap the neighbor holding it.
Exactly. The prince locks Lan Kai He in a dark, gloomy room.
A prison cell, basically.
Yeah, the text calls it a dark room, and then he proudly carries the stolen jade tablet into the main palace.
The reaction of the Dragon King to this development is staggering to me. You might expect a monarch to ask where this sudden glowing artifact came from.
You would hope so.
Or perhaps question if his son just committed an act of unprovoked international terrorism to acquire it. Yeah. Instead, because the palace is now glowing so brightly, it looks like they have a new sun and moon indoors, the Dragon King is thrilled. He immediately orders a celebratory banquet.
He does.
He is either entirely oblivious or willfully ignorant of the violent crime that just occurred in his own waters.
The author creates a brilliant visual contrast here. You have the stolen light bringing unearned joy to the opulent underwater court, while the original owner languishes in a lightless cell.
It's so dark.
But to fully understand the thematic core of this story, we really have to return to the surface and look at how the remaining immortals react to losing their friend.
Right, because the surviving immortals make it to the opposite shore, do a quick head count, and realize Lan Kai is missing. A reasonable expectation would be that these divine beings would immediately form a search party or devise a rescue plan. I mean, they're his friends.
You would think. But instead, Iron Crutch Lai immediately jumps to a really cynical conclusion. He states that this must be the Dragon King making trouble, and therefore they shouldn't even bother looking for him.
Wait, he is just ready to write off his friend without a second thought.
Yeah.
Just, well, the ocean got him, let's keep moving, that's cold.
It is freezing cold. And following that callous dismissal, Zhang Guolao chimes in with what really serves as the central thesis of this entire chapter.
Okay.
He says, and I'll translate here, he says, I said that after drinking, there is no need to show off to raise our spirits, and unexpectedly, it has indeed brought about this disaster.
Wait, after drinking? That detail about drinking completely reframes the opening scene.
It does, doesn't it?
The stunt with the magical items wasn't just a quiet test of skill. It was the divine equivalent of someone shouting, hold my beer, before attempting a dangerous trick.
Exactly. And this is a fascinating subversion of a very common cultural trope in classical Chinese literature.
How so?
Well, in a lot of ancient poetry and Taoist-inspired texts, alcohol is actually celebrated. The drunken immortal is a beloved archetype.
Oh, right. The guy who drinks and becomes enlightened.
Yeah. It's someone who uses wine to loosen the rigid, stifling rules of mortal society, allowing them to access a state of spiritual freedom or artistic brilliance.
The idea that you transcend mundane worries by having a few cups of wine and embracing the moment.
Right. But here, the author flips that concept entirely. Zhang Guolao is pointing out that their drinking did not lead to spiritual transcendence at all. it led to petty vanity.
Instead of dissolving their ego, the alcohol inflated it.
Exactly. They forgot the core Taoist principle of Wu Wei.
Which is the concept of effortless action, right?
Yeah, aligning oneself with the natural flow of the universe, forcing a flashy, unnecessary challenge onto the turbulent, chaotic, natural force of the ocean is the exact opposite of harmony. It is a cautionary tale about how vanity clouds judgment, even for the enlightened.
It reinforces the idea of intoxicated elites playing dangerous games with forces they really shouldn't be messing with. And true to form, the moment there are real consequences, the blame game begins.
Oh, immediately. Zhongli turns to Lu Dongbin.
The guy who started it all.
Right, the immortal who originally proposed the challenge on the beach. And Zhongli essentially places the entire burden on his shoulders. He points out that this was Dongbin's idea, therefore Dongbin needs to be the one to go find Kaihe.
That is brutal.
And then Zhongli announces that the rest of the group will simply head off to their divine gathering and wait for news.
The mundane office politics of this moment is just incredible. They drop the mess squarely in his lap, tell him it sounds like a you problem, and clock out for the day. They completely abandon him to deal with the ocean.
Yeah, it completely shatters any lingering illusion of divine solidarity. So Lu Dongbin is left alone on the beach. He searches the shoreline, fails to find his friend, and resorts to shouting out over the water. He demands that the Dragon King return the person safely, or else he will light a fire and burn the sea completely dry.
He casually threatens to evaporate an entire ocean.
As one does.
Right. So a Yaksha, which is a water demon serving as a scout, hears this screaming from the beach, swims down, and reports the threat to the prince.
Yeah.
And the prince, who is just full of his own ego, surfaces to confront Dongbin.
The prince demands to know who is being so insolent on his shores. Dongbin introduces himself as a supreme immortal, explains that his friend was taken without provocation, and demands his immediate return.
But the prince pushes back with staggering arrogance. He essentially looks at this powerful being and says, "And if I don't give him back, what exactly are you going to do about it?"
Yeah, he really pokes the bear. Dongbin repeats his threat to burn the sea dry. The prince mocks him, tells him to go away, and threatens to capture Dongbin as well.
Bad move.
Very bad move. At this point, Dongbin loses his temper, draws his sword, and charges. The prince, realizing he might actually be outmatched in direct physical combat, quickly flees back into the safety of the deep water.
And here's where it gets really interesting. This is where the escalation moves from a localized dispute to a global catastrophe.
Yeah.
Lu Dongbin doesn't take a moment to cool off or think of a diplomatic solution. He goes straight for the nuclear option.
He does.
He takes out a magical fire gourd and throws it into the sea. And the text specifies that this single gourd multiplies into thousands of gourds. Suddenly, the entire surface of the ocean is burning red. The water itself literally begins boiling.
The specific word the author uses is dingfei, which means boiling like water in a massive tripod cauldron. It is an act of sheer, overwhelming destruction.
We have to pause and look critically at Lu Dongbin's morality in this moment.
Yeah, let's do that.
Because modern readers often approach mythological protagonists expecting them to be heroes, right?
Right.
But Dongbin goes from 0 to 100 in seconds.
I literally.
He is actively boiling an entire ecosystem, a realm filled with thousands of innocent aquatic creatures, spirits, and civilians, all over a hostage situation that he indirectly caused by demanding his friends show off their toys.
It's true.
It feels less like heroic justice and more like the actions of a magical bully having a violent tantrum.
This raises an important question, and that tension is central to understanding how power operates in these ancient epics. In this mythological framework, power often serves as its own justification.
Meaning they don't have to play by our rules.
Exactly. The immortals operate on a hierarchy of spiritual authority that does not bind them to human ethics. However, it is highly probable that the author is using this narrative as a veiled societal critique.
Ah, meaning the text is allowing the reader to enjoy the magical spectacle while quietly observing the monstrous nature of unchecked authority.
Precisely. The sheer disproportionate destruction caused by Dongbin's wounded pride really reflects historical realities. The common people, represented here by the aquatic life suffering in the boiling ocean, are always the ones who pay the horrific price when untouchable elites engage in turf wars over stolen pride.
It is a terrifying worldview.
Mm-hmm.
If you inconvenience a deity, they will literally boil your entire society.
Huh.
Meanwhile, down in the Crystal Palace, the water is rapidly heating up.
Yeah, the palace is thrown into a panic. The Dragon King, who has been happily enjoying his glowing banquet this whole time, finally asks his attendants what all the screaming is about.
A little late for that.
Just a bit. The attendants confess the entire truth. They explain that the prince stole the jade tablet, kidnapped the immortal, locked him in a dark room, and now the powerful immortal on the beach is boiling the ocean because the prince refuses to return the hostage.
Now, a typical mythological king would probably hear that his realm is under attack, gear up for war, and send out an army to defend his honor.
Right.
But the Dragon King takes a completely different approach.
He exhibits a surprising, almost cold-blooded pragmatism. He assesses the boiling water, listens to the facts, and delivers a very calculated judgment.
What does he say?
He states, and again I'm translating, since we stole their item, it is not proper to also imprison the person.
It is the most transactional logic imaginable.
Yeah.
He's essentially saying, look, we successfully got the loot. There is zero reason to hold onto the hostage and get ourselves boiled alive for it. Just throw the guy back.
Exactly. He orders his subordinates to immediately release Lan Kaihi. The aquatic soldiers bring Kaihi up to the shore, where he bumps into Lu Dongbin.
Awkward reunion.
Very. They exchange a quick summary of events. Dongbin, seeing his friend is safe, recalls his fire gourds, the ocean stops boiling, and the two of them casually walk off to join the other immortals to discuss the situation.
They just walk away, leaving a devastated ecosystem behind them.